From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, 30 years of working in L.A. with gang members transitioning out of the life. We talk with Father Greg Boyle, the founder of Homeboy Industries, which runs cafes, restaurants, and other businesses with the mission of training and hiring former gang members. Father Greg says he continues to find God in the insight born of sadness, and he continues to pray, but his prayers aren't a way of asking God for favors or to fix things.
Prayer is not going to fix our healthcare system. Stop it, you know? don't think that. You actually have to do something about guns. You can't just pray.
Also, we talk with Matt and Ross Duffer, the creators of the Netflix sci-fi horror series Stranger Things. The second season is streaming now. And Ken Tucker reviews Taylor Swift's new album, Reputation. First news. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Father Greg Boyle, has worked with former gang members in L.A. for over 30 years. He's the founder of Homeboy Industries, which was created to help former gang members and people transitioning out of prison create stable lives and stay out of gangs. Instead of Father Greg trying to convince business owners to hire young people who are at risk, he created jobs for them through Homeboy Industries. Homeboy is a series of businesses, including a restaurant, a bakery, cafe, farmers markets, created with the purpose of hiring these young people so they can have on-the-job training. The employees come from rival gangs, so they have to put aside their distrust and hatred of each other. Homeboy also provides other job training and social service programs. It's now the largest gang intervention and reentry program in the U.S. Back in the 80s and 90s, Father Greg spent a lot of time on the streets. He's witnessed shootings, he's buried over 200 young people, and he's kept on with the work in spite of being diagnosed with a chronic form of leukemia about 15 years ago. He started working with gangs in 1986 when he became the pastor of the Dolores Mission Church in East L.A., which was then the city's poorest Catholic parish. He's just written his second book called Barking to the Choir, The Power of Radical Kinship. Father Greg Boyle, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's great to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
And I know you have a little bit of laryngitis, so thank you for coming in spite of that. So you now make a distinction between employment, which is what you do with Homeboy Industries. You give people jobs for an 18-month period, and these are people who have either been in prison or have been in gangs and want to change their life. You may now make this distinction. You say that, like, employment isn't necessarily going to totally change someone's life. They might end up back in prison. But if somebody's healed, that will change their life, possibly forever. What's the distinction you make between employment and the opportunity that you're giving them and healing?
30 years ago when we started Homeboy Industries, the motto was, nothing stops a bullet like a job. And that was a response to gang members saying, if only we had work. And that was essential. But then when we discovered that, you know, we would dispatch gang members to jobs, but the minute any kind of monkey wrench was tossed into the mix, they would unravel, you know, that there was no resilience, there was no healing. And they would go right back to gang life or go back to prison. So probably 15 years ago, we said, you know, healing is probably more necessary, along with the fact that people need to have a reason to get up in the morning and a place to go and a reason not to gangbang. So we kind of altered in an essential way that if people don't have a foundational, fundamental healing, you know, then it's going to be really difficult for them to navigate their lives.
So that sounds great. Healing is really life-changing. It's just really hard. I mean, some of the people you describe in your book who you've worked with, there's one person who when he was a child, he took the batteries out of his father's dresser for one of his kid's toys. When his father got home and found his batteries were missing and that his son took his batteries, he took his son's arm and just snapped it in two. You talk about people whose parent would put their head in the toilet and flush the toilet and nearly drown them. Basically, that's waterboarding your child in a toilet. So when people have been brought up like this, and they're also poor and they have no real future prospects, how do you heal them? Like, what can heal somebody who's been through that?
Well, part of what we have at Homeboy is this irresistible culture of tenderness, you know, where people kind of hold each other. It's a place of containment. And they all come with chronic toxic stress that's attached to them like a big old heavy backpack. And if they can find relief, then they no longer have to actually operate out of survivor brain. And then they can find our place as something of a sanctuary. And they can come to terms with what was done to them and also what they did. And then we always say at Homeboy, if you don't transform your pain, you're just going to keep transmitting it. So it breaks this cycle. And pretty soon, if they cooperate and surrender to it, then they become the sanctuary that they sought there. And then they go home and they provide that sanctuary to their kids, and suddenly you've broken a cycle.
But in addition to the tenderness, I'm sure you also, and that your staff also has to say, you didn't show up for work today, and that's not good. Or you're not really doing the job. And then what? Like, if somebody isn't doing the job, if they're not showing up on time, you know, what's the other side of the tenderness that you have to show them?
We don't get tripped up so much by behavior. Even gang violence itself is a language. You want to, well, what language is it speaking? You know, it's not about the flying of bullets. It's about a lethal absence of hope. So let's address the despair. And the same thing is with behavior. I mean, we bring it up, and at some point we say, we think you're telling us that you're not ready to be here. We love you. We think you're great. Come back when you're ready. So that's the thing we do often enough. And we drug test because we don't want anyone to numb their pain as they do the work.
Yeah, I'm going to stop you right there because that's an interesting reason you've given. You're not saying we drug test because drugs are illegal. You're saying we drug test because that numbs the pain and we don't want them to be numbing themselves. Why are you putting it that way?
Because they're not going to be able to transform their pain if they're inebriated or if they're constantly smoking marijuana. And they're used to that. They're used to self-medicating. They're used to escape. They want to find that place where they can't see their pain from. And the antidote really is to hold them in a place that where they feel cherished. And once that kind of steady harmonizing love infiltrates the place where they show up every day, and they kind of have a palpable sense of no matter whatness, that these folks are even in my corner, even if they have to let me go. In fact, a lot of people kind of relapse in that sense, and homies come back. You know, it's the third time is the charm sometimes. Then it takes, because it takes what it takes. People have to be responsive and fully cooperative in the healing. If it's too hard for them, we'll come back when you're ready to do this. And I would say they almost always do, which is a sign that somehow they got a dose of something that they want more of.
So the people you work with have often been the perpetrators or victims of gun violence. We've seen so many mass shootings and such tragedy, and so much controversy, not only about what the gun laws should be, but about, is it too soon to even talk about what the gun laws should be? So having seen the results of gun violence on the perpetrators and the victims, do you have a sense of where these guns come from, how the people you know get the guns?
I think it's the easiest thing there is for homies and gang members to get guns. And, you know, there's a network and a black market and a underground ability to locate anything they need. And then there's, you know, the misconceptions, you know, homies will occasionally come into the office and someone will say, yeah, he's packing a gun. And so we escort them outside or, you know, and then you ask them, you know, why do you have a gun? And they'll always say the exact same thing that never varies, for my protection. And you can't get them to identify a single time that they can recall in their life or anybody they know who was ever protected by a gun, ever. And nobody has enough time to talk about how much destruction and mayhem and the ending of life guns have brought to the community in which I live. So it's hard to reason with folks who think that way. But no reasonable person thinks it's ever too soon to discuss sensible gun laws.
Do you think sensible gun laws would affect the gun violence in your community since so many of the guns are being purchased on the black market?
I think it might, you know, in terms of the kind of high caliber things that you see, but not really. You know, clearly we're too armed as a country, and there's nothing sensible about that. But if you just talked about health, no healthy person ever, you know, is going to go into a church and shoot people up. So if you really want to address things, then you want to kind of get at what language is this speaking? So you can deliver certainly mental health services in a timely, culturally appropriate way. But it's about health, even in the gang world. You know, the shooters are almost always the most damaged and mentally ill.
With the help of cell phone videos and dashboard videos, Americans have seen with their own eyes how some police officers assault or kill black men. And is that something that gang members you've worked with, ex-offenders that you've worked with, have complained about? And if so, have you worked with officers, with police officers, and spoken to them about your concerns?
Well, for the first time in 30 years, you know, we've had police officers in training at the police academy. They're brought over to Homeboy Industries to kind of spend the day. And it's a softening of who are these people? And it helps, you know, to have gang members stand up in front of a room full of police officers who are in training and allow them in, you know, invite them to the difficulties of their own growing up and what they had to endure. And if you can lead them to a place of awe, which is a great leveler, and then pretty soon they stand in awe at what these folks have had to carry rather than in judgment at how they've carried it. So it softened the demonizing.
So, Father Greg, how are you? You were diagnosed with leukemia about 15 years ago. After treatment, you went into remission or something close to it, even though it's a chronic condition. So how are you doing now?
I'm good. You know, the homies still say, I hear your cancer's in intermission. that it has apparently stepped out to the lobby to buy popcorn. You know, the past 2 years, I have had to go through immunotherapy and radiation recently. But it's, you know, I would not trade this for anything because it allows homies to be tender in a way that's different than the usual thing. You know, they would just do anything for you. And they express it constantly in my presence or usually on a text, and very sweet, very kind, and you feel cherished, you know. So, I mean, again, my health has never been kind of on my top 10 list of things I ever worry about.
Why not? Why isn't it?
Meeting payroll always has been.
I understand that. But I also understand that, you know, like if someone has any form of cancer, that usually rises pretty much to the top of the list of concerns.
Yeah, I think the only answer to that is I'm probably weird. But okay. I think part of it, too, is that a kid who I buried used to say right after his brother died in his arms, also gunned down, and he was gunned down 2 years after that, he said, death is a punk. And I said, yeah, you know, you're right. So I think a lot of it has to do, people are kind of stunned that none of us will get out of this alive. And that kind of startles me. I want to say, where you been? You know, and it's kind of an indicator of, you know, the work that everybody has to do is no one gets out of this alive. So once you know that, then all of a sudden death is a punk. You know, the Dalai Lama, somebody asked him about his own personal death, and he just laughed, and he said, change of clothing. And yeah, I'll have what he's having, you know, because I think that's what it is. So the minute you're freed from not just the notion of death, but you're freed from the fear of it, and I know that cancer and death is not the worst thing that could ever happen to somebody. And once you know that, then you can compile the lists, you know, the list of fates worse than death and the things more powerful than death.
Did you feel called to be a priest? I mean, how did you know you wanted to be a priest?
I was giving a talk the other night and somebody said, when did you feel called to priesthood? And I said, the day of my ordination. I don't even know why that popped out of my mouth. But I think it's probably true. I was educated by the Jesuits, and I loved the Jesuits. And they were hilarious and prophetic. And this was during the Vietnam War. And they just, you know, let's hop in the van. And we're driving to San Francisco to the biggest anti-war protest in the country's history. Yeah, let's do it. I love that stuff. That's why I became a Jesuit. And for me, that was just the combo burger that made me want to become a Jesuit. Priest was kind of later, but Jesuit was my first and foremost thing.
As a Jesuit priest, how much say do you have about where you're going to be assigned to work and what your work will be like? Did you ask to work with gang members? Was that just the outcome of the neighborhood you were assigned to?
Well, I was ordained a priest in 84, and then I went to Bolivia to learn Spanish, really. And then it just turned me inside out. It's what you would call being evangelized by the poor. I just said, I want to cast my lot with the poorest folks I can find. And it felt to me the fullness of where my life had led me to that point. So I was supposed to go to Santa Clara University to work kind of in the campus ministry there, and I just couldn't do it. So I went to my provincial, please send me to the poorest place you can. And then by luck, they sent me to Dolores Mission, and I figured I'd be the third guy on the totem pole, but nobody was there when I got there. So I was the pastor. I was the youngest pastor in the history of the diocese. You didn't make people my age pastor. And then it was a vocation within a vocation within a vocation. And then 88 started when I started to bury kids. And then it was, I feel connected to these folks. And so then I knew every gang member. And we had the highest concentration of gang activity in all of Los Angeles was my parish. So you could bury your head in the sand or you could roll up your sleeves. And so it was all an evolution.
What was your understanding of prayer when you were in parochial school compared to what your understanding of prayer is now?
You know, in those days, it was rote and it was petitionary and it was, I know I didn't study for the math test, but please let me pass it. You know, craziness. It, which led people to go, I didn't pass the math test, so much for prayer. So, I mean, again, it was third grade. But I had experiences when I was in high school where it was profound and unitive and really feeling held and loved and worthy.
Is prayer for you a quiet recitation, you know, of pre-written prayer or moments of reflection that have no text attached to it?
Yeah, I don't have any text. I have mantras all the time, but I try to meditate twice a day and in the morning, and then if I can do it during the afternoon or when I steal away some time for lunch.
Do you ever do petitional prayer anymore? Is there a place for that in your
Well, home? I mean, it's in the liturgy, you know, where people, you know, let's pray for this guy who died and let's pray for unity in our country. And all those things are good because it's people are articulating kind of what's on their mind. And it's a way for people to stand with each other. You know, I may not be able to carry what you're carrying, but we can carry you. And that's kind of what prayer in a petitionary sense means. But I never do it personally because I don't, you know, when people say, I believe in the power of prayer, or Speaker Ryan said the other day, prayer works. I go, well, now talk about that. It helps me find God at the center of my life. So yes, it does work. But prayer is not going to fix our healthcare system. Stop it, you know? don't think that. You actually have to do something about guns. You can't just pray, and you can't just, again, extend thoughts and prayers. And so the power of prayer, I don't think people have got that. People haven't graduated from the third grade. They're stuck there. They're still praying for the math test when there are things that are in our control and that we're supposed to do. And that God doesn't protect us from Hurricane Maria, but will sustain us as we lock arms with each other in its aftermath. I believe in that.
So if you're not doing petitional prayer, when you have someone who you deeply care about, who's gone through Homeboy Industries, who's trying to change their life, and they're sick or they've been hurt, and they're in the hospital and they're hanging on maybe by a thread, when you pray for them, what are you doing? Are you asking for them to be healed? Is that too petitional for you to do? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yesterday, you know, one of our homies who's worked for us for a long time, and I buried his brother, and his father was dying. So I went over to the hospital. We all gathered around. You know, I'm a priest, so I do the anointing of the sick. I anoint his forehead, and I invite everybody in the room. There were probably 10 of us. And each one kind of anointed him very tenderly. And we all touched him, and I said a blessing. Clearly he, you know, had a major stroke, and clearly he was leaving us. And 10 minutes later, he did. I was so glad I got there. Not because this was some magical, you know, thing, but that it meant a lot to this homie who works for me. And it meant a lot to just sort of gather together. But you're not praying for some outcome. You're trying to, you know, step into this, into the wideness of God. You know, this amazing, merciful, spacious, and expansive God. And then all of a sudden, because you're praying, because you're bringing this consciousness to the group, everybody is experiencing the tender glance of God in that moment. And then you feel animated to leave each other's presence and to be that tender glance in the world. That's how it works. But the magical thinking of pray that this person get healed. And it's not even pray for God's will, because people die and people get sick. And there's nobody who's not going to have that happen to them. But in the process, we can lock arms with each other. And the prayer is just a way of, you know, putting first things first.
Well, Father Greg, it's been great to talk with you again. Thank you so much. I wish you good health.
Thank you, Terry. Always good being with you.
Father Greg Boyle is the founder of the Gang Intervention and Reentry Program, Homeboy Industries, and author of the new book, Barking to the Choir. Our rock critic, Ken Tucker, has a review of Taylor Swift's new album, her sixth. It's called Reputation. It's her first album since her 2014 album, which was called 1989. 1989 represented Swift's move away from the country music genre where she started her career, and Ken says Reputation pushes her even further into pop music territory.
No, nothing good starts in a getaway car. It was the best of times, the worst of crimes. I struck a match and blew your mind, but I didn't mean it, and you didn't see it. The ties were black, the lies were white. Shades of gray and candlelight. I wanted to leave him. I needed a reason. X marks the spot.
The pulsing drum beats, the surging keyboards, the distorted or multi-tracked vocals. Taylor Swift has relocated herself far from country music on her new album, Reputation. 3 years ago, she called 1989 her first official pop album. This one is her move into electronic dance music, and the EDM instrumentation and rhythms seem a comfortable framework for her songwriting. I like the way she makes synthesizers do the work of church organs on the gospel pop of Don't Blame Me.
Don't blame me, love made me crazy. If it doesn't, you ain't doing it right. Lord save me, my drug is my baby, I'd be using for the rest of my life. Breaking hearts a long time and toying with them older guys just to play things for me to use. Something happened for the first time in the darkest little paradise, shaking, pacing, I just need you. For you I would cross the line, I would waste my time, I would lose my mind. They say she's gone too far this time.
Swift remains a master at creating the sound of yearning, the push and pull of romantic attraction versus emotional conflict. She's working once again with some of the biggest pop hitmaker producers, Jack Antonoff, Max Martin, and Shellback. But listening to the music, you never think for a second that she has ceded control to them. There's a reason she's billed as executive producer above them. Listen to the way she makes her breathy vocal sound sure and strong as it surges around the melody of the gorgeous song called Delicate.
Dive bar on the east side, where you at? Phone lights at my nightstand in the black. Come here, you can meet me in the back. Dark jeans and your Nikes, look at you. Oh damn, never seen that color blue. Just think of the fun things we could do. Cause I like you. This ain't for the best. My reputation's never been worse, so you must like me for me. Now can we be? But you can make me dream. Is it cool that I said all that? Is it chill that you're in my head? Cause I know that it's delicate.
Swift has a new song called Gorgeous. The lyric presents her as a woman flirting with a guy while her boyfriend isn't looking, enjoying the kind of social privilege usually reserved in pop songs for men. Gorgeous finds Swift half-singing, half-talking the verses, only to break into a lovely falsetto croon on the chorus, which has an irresistible bubblegum pop hook.
You should take it as a compliment that I got drunk and made fun of the way you talk. You should think about the consequence of your magnetic field being a little too strong.
One reason Swift felt it necessary to move on from country music is that she found its myth of authenticity constraining for the size of her pop stardom. For a previous generation of confessional singer-songwriters, this dilemma used to represent a crisis point. But Swift need not worry. For her audience, the lyrics of a new song such as This Is Why We Can't Have Nice Things may sound like a thinly veiled reference to her public arguments with Kanye West and Kim Kardashian. It operates as a joke on the glory of success. And the song also works on a more straightforward level. I hear it as, sometimes friends betray you.
It was so nice being friends again. There I was giving you a second chance, but you stabbed me in the back while shaking my head. And therein lies the issue. Friends don't try to trick you, get you on the phone and mind twist you. And so I took an axe to amend it this. But I'm not the only friend you've lost lately. Mm-mm. If only you weren't so shady. This is why we can't have nice things, darling.
The usual rap against the kind of electro-pop Swift is deploying here is that it can too easily sound chilly and distancing. Robotic. This is the exact opposite of how Taylor Swift sounds on Reputation. She comes across as eager, with an enjoyable theatricality. She's found a way to echo the teen vulnerability that first brought her success, while demonstrating how an adult can process those emotions with a control that does not negate passion.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Taylor Swift's new album, Reputation. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Our guests, the Duffer Brothers, are the creators of the popular Netflix sci-fi horror series Stranger Things. The show takes place in the 1980s in the fictional small town of Hawkins, Indiana, where a group of middle school friends investigate supernatural goings-on, including interdimensional monsters and a secretive lab run by the Department of Energy. Stranger Things is in part an homage to the 80s pop culture that the Duffer Brothers loved as kids, like movies by John Carpenter and Steven Spielberg, and the novels of Stephen King. In keeping with the sequel-filled 80s, the Duffer Brothers titled the second season of their show Stranger Things 2. Matt and Ross Duffer are twins who sound very much alike and tend to finish each other's sentences. Before we hear the interview they recorded with Fresh Air producer Sam Brigger, let's hear a clip from the new season. In this scene, Dr. Sam Owens is evaluating Will Byers, a boy who in the last season was trapped in another dimension, an evil-looking place called the Upside Down. Since then, he's either having flashbacks or new encounters with the Upside Down. The doctor is played by Paul Reiser, and Will is played by Noah Schnapp.
So how did you feel when you saw the storm?
I felt frozen.
Heart racing?
Just frozen.
Like frozen, cold frozen? Frozen to the touch?
No, like how you feel when you're scared and you can't breathe or talk or do anything. I felt this evil, like it was looking at me.
It was evil? Well, what do you think the evil wanted?
To kill.
To kill you?
Not me. Everyone else.
Matt and Ross Duffer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So you called the second season Stranger Things 2, so you're clearly marking it as a sequel. You guys are such big film fans. Did you talk to each other about, like, what are the rules of sequels and what are sequels supposed to do?
Yes, we did. But I think Netflix, when we first mentioned this, that we saw it as a sequel, got worried because most sequels are, you know, generally disappointments. And so a lot of what we did was just sort of looking at the sequels that, you know, we loved so much growing up and seeing how they succeeded and then trying our best to follow in those footsteps and not mess this thing up.
What were some of the sequels that you really loved?
I mean, we always go like James Cameron is sort of the master of it. He did two of the greatest sequels of all time, which was one of, you know, a sequel to his own movie, which was T2, Terminator 2.
And
then he also
too,
did right. Aliens. And so we kind of looked at how he was able to do that. It's like they're arguably better than the originals. It retained a lot of the mythology of the originals and the feeling of it, but then it expanded on it in a really exciting way. So it felt like there was a reason for it to exist. And they scaled up. That was something we talked about. We wanted to scale it up a little bit.
Right. More monsters.
I know. It's the cliche. It's like one monster, multiple monsters. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, like, there's something like very childish about us, you know, if you get to know us. It's like, so we wanted to do that even though we knew we'd get some flack for it. But it's like, it's fun. And we wanted it to feel bigger, you know, than season one.
Yeah. What were you interested in expanding in the storyline?
Well, I mean, first of all, there were a lot of characters we introduced in season one. So we wanted to get into them a little bit more, learn about who they are. We have the character of Dustin and Lucas, who were kind of like, people loved them last year, but we didn't get into their houses. We didn't get to meet their family. So it was like, suddenly you have all this additional time to explore these characters because we fell in love with these actors and what they're able to do. And like, so you get to expand on the character level. And then you also get to expand it in terms of, we wanted some of these big, spectacular blockbuster visual effects and put those into the show. I mean, that was something I was really excited about doing. And it's something you don't often see in TV. You know, Game of Thrones has been doing it. And I thought that some of that stuff is really revolutionary because they're taking these spectacular visual effects sequences that you see in the movies. But right now, you know, in the movies, that's all you're seeing. So you don't actually care about what's happening. So your eyes are like really wild, but like you don't feel anything. There's something soulless about it. You know, when Game of Thrones applies those sort of visuals to sequences involving characters that you're really super invested in because you've spent so many hours with them, getting to know them, then that's like really, really powerful. So, you know, we wanted to do some of that this year.
So the Upside Down is the name that the kids give this alternate universe that all these scary monsters come out of. Can you just describe it a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, we really saw it as sort of a nightmare version of our world. But as we started breaking the story and we realized we needed to go in there, but we didn't have the money to turn it into a visual effects extravaganza, and we didn't. We just thought that would take you right out of the story. And so we ended up just sort of grounding it and using our locations, but then just sort of, you know, adding vines on it and then adding these a version of snow, which is these what we call spores. Mm-hmm. And so what happens then is it's actually a very easy thing for us to achieve, but it just sort of creates this horrific version of what already exists.
Well, the kids are just so great in the shows. Is it true that when you were casting, you looked at 1,000 auditions? And what were you looking for? And did you want to cast like one of the kids first, or you just found one and then it all fell into place? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it was certainly over 1,000. And some of that gets weeded out by our casting director. Mm-hmm. And then otherwise, you can generally tell instantly with this stuff. You don't need to watch a full audition and debate whether this kid is right or not. It was generally with all of our main kids, you knew within a few seconds of them speaking, because what we were looking for is just something that felt authentic, because there's this sort of, you would call it sort of like the Disney Channel kid, which is there just overdoing it. They're like trying to be cute, whereas our kids all to us just felt, there was just something authentic about it. I remember Finn Wolfhard, who plays Mike, was just, he was like sick when he filmed his audition, and he was just like lying on the bed and his dad filmed him with his crappy phone and it just looked terrible, but it didn't matter because it just felt real. And even though Finn wasn't how we imagined Mike at all originally, he's much more of a manic, fidgety energy than we ever expected for Mike. But it doesn't matter. Once we found this group of kids, we then ended up shaping the characters around them.
What were you guys like as kids? Did you have a close-knit group of friends like this?
We did, especially in elementary and middle school, and our best friend that lived right next door to us. You know, every summer we would make a movie together. He would be our co-director and co-writer. We didn't really write. It was more like rough outlines that then we'd improv together. And, you know, then we would get all of our friends together and we would make these movie. So a lot of Stranger Things is actually pulling from that and just trying to recapture a bit of what those summers felt like. Because even though we weren't fighting monsters or discovering telepathic girls, we
in our heads we were. Well, I mean, we were imagining
that's what you're hoping
all that.
For, probably.
Yeah.
Feel like these big adventures. And yes, are we referencing Stand By Me when we have our characters walking down train tracks? Yes, but also we were walking down train tracks as kids. And so, you know, a lot of it is trying our best to recapture those summer childhood experiences.
You know, monsters aside, the kids in your show are going through some really tough times in terms of they're going through adolescence. I mean, and it's an incredibly intense time. They're dealing with their first crush that's testing their friendships. People are moody and they're jealous. They're pulling away from their parents. I think you really capture that really well. Did you have a good sense memory of how fraught those times were?
I just remember being incredibly insecure, you know, especially moving into high school, being extremely anxious, not really knowing.
Just socially? Or?
Socially, yeah. I mean, we were socially, we struggled a lot. I think it started out because it started out even really, really young, like, because we wouldn't hang out with anyone aside from each other. Like, so it was only just me and Ross. And, you know, the teachers got concerned because they were like, we weren't developing the proper social skills to function in society, basically. It was like, they're not prepared to function. So we were actually, they were like, they need to repeat kindergarten, which we did. So I've been behind a year my entire life, which always made me feel weird. We're twins. There are a lot more twins now. When we were growing up in North Carolina, there were no twins. Hmm. And everyone's like, it must be so great to be a twin, but I hated it because it was like, even though I loved my brother and Aaron, it made you feel weird and different and like you didn't fit in. And really, when you're that age, all you want to do is fit in.
You guys are making movies like starting in third grade. I think the first one was based on a card game called Magic the Gathering, which is kind of like a second or third generation D&D kind of game in terms of like fantasy. So you would get your friends to star in these roles, and then you have some big production value pieces.
I mean, we didn't have a lot of actors. We would also act.
And editing is more than anything what started to teach us how to be filmmakers, that you can shoot a scene. I mean, it's very crude and basic, but to us, it really altered our little films, which is you can film a scene multiple times, and then we can splice this together, and then we can put the music underneath, and suddenly our projects became much more sophisticated. And so
by that he means watchable.
Yeah.
I will say though, there was one moment where we flirted with popularity in high school, which was when people realized that our videos, if used for a class assignment, would get you an automatic A. And so it took me like a few months to realize I was just being used. They would only hang out with us while we were making the film for them. And then they would, once they got their A, then I would never hear from them again until they needed another video. And at some point I was like, why am I doing this?
I remember it was I got a call from a cool kid, and he's like, "We're for history class, we want to, you know, film the storming of Normandy." And I was like, okay, because this is Saving Private Ryan, you know, had been out recently. Mm-hmm. I was like, okay, when do you want to do the storming of Normandy? And they're like, this afternoon at Jordan Lake. And so I was like, well, I guess I should hang out with the cool kid. So I went out there with our camera.
Yeah, I wasn't there, actually.
No, and I adjusted the colors on the camera, and I adjusted the shutter speed. And I just shook it a lot, and these kids are coming with their, like, squirt guns and rafts, but I shook the camera a lot. And then when I got back and put in into iMovie, Matt and I ripped the sound effects from Saving Private Ryan, which really is, like, a huge part of the I mean, those are Oscar-winning
effects. Great sound.
Some of the best sound design ever.
And if you put that with shaky camera of kids, like, suddenly this thing came alive. And they for 10 years, history class still showed that project.
Yeah.
I'm sure maybe now they've stopped, but for a while
why would they have stopped now?
But that was the catalyst for then after that every weekend we had to film a movie.
All right, so you made a movie in 2015, Hidden, and you wrote a few episodes of the show Wayward Pines. But, you know, Stranger Things, being in charge of your own multi-million-dollar movie seems like a huge step forward. When you got on the set, did you feel like you were over your head at some point?
Yeah.
Not as over the head as on our first movie, which was just felt like you're just being thrown into the deep end. It was more like that experience was so traumatizing for us, and we were so nervous going on to Stranger Things. It was less about running the set and more about getting it finished in time. My least favorite thing about filming is that you're always running out of time. You never have time to get it right. You never have time to do as many takes as you want to get the scene just right. So it's always, from the second you step on set, you're racing.
Like, I remember on our first movie, I guess we were 27, you know, and then you're like in this multi-million-dollar Warner Brother movie with movie stars and stuff. And you need to convince people that you know what you're doing, but you don't totally know what you're doing. And I think that because of that, you have this thing called playback, which we don't have on Stranger Things, by the way, just to protect ourselves. But most movies and most TV shows have playback where you can, you know, once you shoot a scene, you can watch it. You can watch what you just did.
You said that you don't have playback on the set of Stranger Things to protect yourselves. What do you mean?
So we have so little time on Stranger Things that if you're unsure whether you got something or not, by the time you watch to check whether you had it, you could have just shot it again.
So you just shoot it
again.
And the beauty of digital, and some people complain about it, that it's hurting sort of discipline on film sets, which I can understand that. But especially when something with kids is, we don't even have to cut the camera. We just go again, just one more time, say this line one more time, and then just say douchebag or just whatever it is, and then And that can help sort of get the energy up of a scene, and then you're just like, okay, we got it, moving
but
on.
But usually you can't just shout at actors off screen or they get really irritated at you.
But
I'm like, I can't shout at Winona, like, Winona, do it again, but this way. With kids, you can shout at them from off screen. They won't get offended. You can literally grab them and move them if they're not on their mark, you know, if they're not where they're supposed to be. You can physically move them. Huh. You know, you can't do that with David Harbour. You cannot do that with Winona without getting smacked.
So how do you guys work together? Do you split up the writing and directing, or is it all collaborative? Do you feel like one of you is better, like Matt's better at writing dialogue and Ross is better at writing plot? Or
we usually get annoyed at each other when we answer these questions. I'm better at this. And you're like, wait a minute, you really think that? So that I may dodge, but I think that the benefit of two, you're really working as one voice when you're on set, because most of the decisions that we're making comes in the writing. And so on set is just executing it, whereas the writing is, you know, it's very collaborative as we're breaking story and breaking outlines with each other and other writers. But then as we're writing scenes, you know, we each write a scene separately. We pass it to each other. Someone, the other one does a pass and we pass it back. I don't think we'd be able to do this otherwise. It speeds everything up dramatically, times two.
But the funny thing is, to write scripts, you use this program, Final Draft. You're not able to be on that at the same time. So a lot of our work is actually done on Google Docs. And so we don't speak to each other. It's a really weird thing where we're like both on headphones, not talking, and just typing kind of on the same document at the same time. Huh. And sometimes we'll get in like little Google Doc wars.
Are you seated next to each other? Are you in the same office?
We're
in the same room.
In the same room, the same office. It's desks. We have separate desks. We're not like literally right next to each other, because then we'd probably punch each other every once in a while. So good, there's a little bit of physical distance. But we'll get in like Google Doc wars, you know what I mean? Like where I type a line of dialogue or an idea for the scene, he'll delete it. I'll go write it back in, he'll delete it again, and then the headphones come off and we get, then we actually have to have a conversation about it. So it's a little ridiculous.
So when Netflix released season one, were you surprised by the success and the popularity of the show?
Oh, yeah.
For sure, yeah. I mean, there's so much content out there in the world that the fear was you're just going to get lost, even if people do like it. And then we thought best case scenario, though, is you were appealing to people like us that are nostalgic for this style of storytelling. So, you know, the surprise to us came when especially the younger generation started to fall in love with these characters and start tweeting about it, and then word started to spread. I mean, Netflix was always behind the show and they always loved it, but what they thought and what they told us is that, you know, they were hoping that word of mouth would spread, but it's going to take some time. That was sort of what it was. And word of mouth certainly is what got the show its popularity, but I think everyone was taken aback by how quickly that word of mouth spread.
That's great.
So, yeah, no, it's exciting, but it's exciting now. Like, the most exciting thing I'm seeing is that people are discovering the show who had never watched it in the first place. They're, like, starting to get annoyed about hearing about it, and they're like, fine, I guess I'll watch it, which is great. So, you know, you want someone who's like, I find kids annoying, I don't like monsters, I don't watch anything sci-fi, and then suddenly they're watching it.
That's the hope.
That's the goal.
Matt and Ross Dufford, thanks so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for having us.
The Duffer brothers created the Netflix series Stranger Things. They spoke with Fresh Air producer Sam Brugger.